The Catholics of Oz is brought to you by the StarQuest Production Network and is made possible by our many generous patrons. If you'd like to support the podcast, please visit sqpn.com/give.
You're listening to episode 117 of The Catholics of Oz. The Catholics of Oz is a show where we discuss faith, culture, and what's been happening from an Aussie perspective. Whether it's synods or science, apostolates and apps, providence or productivity, you can hear it right now on The Catholics of Oz. Hello, I'm Lindsay Sant. Welcome to episode 117. So good to have you with us. And joining me today, only joining me today because Caroline can't be with us today, but that's all right. We'll venture on without her. Is my, as I call him sometimes, my brother from another mother, my wingman, Lito Samol. Lito, how are you going today?
I'm doing well, Lindsay. I'm doing well. Yes, Caroline, we'll miss you again for another science topic. And I was hoping to do a Roman concrete part two, but
We need a Roman concrete part two. We really do. And a melting robots and all these great topics.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That we need all of these, right? Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. I should mention that, yes, I do call Lino and I refer to each other as each other's wigman every so often. And once in a while, we'll even reenact the scene from Top Gun. We might have to bleep out a word or two from it, but we'll reenact the,
yes.
Yeah. Followed by the.
Definitely.
And then we'll reenact the music. We'll both go. A bit like that. Yeah. We might do a bet. I didn't prepare Lito for that. So
not getting messed up with a danger zone.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. Feeling the need for speed or just for podcasting today?
We're ready to go for both. Why not?
Yeah. All right, let's do it. So we will. We've got an interesting topic for our science topic later on that Caroline has approved. She's given it her seal of approval. All we need now is for her to listen to it later and give it her official imprimatur, and we should be fine. We'll see.
Yes, hopefully she'll be right.
Yeah, and if we make a mistake, she'll correct it in the next episode, so we'll be right.
Yes, yes, guys. Yeah, that's not how you say the word.
I have notes. Yeah, yes. That's not how you say moon. Yeah. All right. So let's move on. First of all, if you're new to listening to The Catholics of Oz, welcome. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast player. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating wherever you listen and some positive feedback so that we can firstly hear from you and also so that we can reach new people, because creating a bit of community is what we are all about. SQPN also hosts The Catholics of Oz on YouTube. You can search for SQPN there, subscribe, and then hit the bell to get notifications when new episodes of this show and all of the other great shows are released. So with that, let's begin with Faith Beyond Borders.
Well, I'm actually feeling rather good about this. I think we've all arrived at a very special place, eh? Oh. Spiritually, ecumenically.
How do you make somebody love you without affecting free will?
Welcome to my world, son. You come up with an answer to that one, you let me know.
Yes, I had to work very hard to pass Latin and theology.
Oh, quite. Those are, of course, the most important things.
Oh, yeah.
I'd sit this one out, Cap.
I don't see how I can.
These guys come from legend. They're basically gods.
There's only one god, man. And I'm pretty sure he doesn't dress like that.
Yeah, so Lino, keeping in the tradition of talking about St. Patrick's Cathedral, so last episode we spoke, so because Carol and I had attended the Patrick Oration, which was delivered by Archbishop Comensoli, friend of the show, trademark.
Cool.
Yep.
No, yeah. Would have been the next time we'd be able to get him on the podcast.
Oh, we are looking at doing.
Is he very busy? But understand,
well,
totally understand.
With Easter and a bit of the post-Easter, yep.
Yeah, exactly.
Man, but we're going to contact the office and find a time this year to have him on, because we'd love to talk about his oration and so many other things that, you know. So we're looking forward to that, because it's been a while too. Been 2 years? We need to.
Wow, 2 years. I think it was before COVID, was it? Or during COVID?
I'm trying to. I think there was one during
2019?
Lockdowns. Yeah.
Or 2020? Yeah. We had him over. Oh my goodness me. Oh, wow.
If we're having this conversation, we need to have him back on the show. So we'll do that.
We definitely need to invite him back on.
Yeah, that's exactly. Right. Yeah.
It's like when our partners and people, they ask us, have you done the vacuuming? I can't remember. If you can't remember, you haven't done it for a while. Yeah, and then you start doing it.
And if you can't remember the last time you had the Archbishop on your show, it's been too long. Yeah. So as we talked last week, or last episode, I should say, about the Patrick Oration and about Archbishop Commensoli's vision for the cathedral, St. Patrick's Cathedral going forward. We even reminisced on some of our fond memories of St. Patrick's Cathedral and how it's been a center of our faith in so many ways over the years of our lives as well. So, So it reminded me of a two-part article that I'd seen in the Melbourne Catholic weeks and weeks and weeks ago. In fact, the 5th of February and the 16th of February, two parts were released. And it's about the history of the decision-making and the ups and downs of building St. Patrick's Cathedral in Melbourne. So I thought we might just delve a little bit into it, do a bit of Australian Catholic history today.
Yeah. Isn't that a TV show? Oh, no, not the Catholic side of it, but there's Australian history.
I'm sure there was
Australian stories, yeah. I'm thinking about. Oh,
no, Australian stories. Yeah, that's another one. Yeah, it was an ABC series. Yeah.
True.
We won't have the journalistic quality of the ABC. However, it's just a couple of guys talking about the cathedral, having a coffee. But, you know, however, we'll delve into this topic because I think it's an interesting one to share. So clearly in going forward, it's always good to look back, right? Look back and then use that as a reference point for going forward, because it is the vision building on a vision which already existed. So, and then recreating and updating, renewing that vision for, as he mentioned, the Zoomers, right? The next generations who will use it after we're all gone. But what happens next? So, so from my reading, this cathedral took about 40 years to build, which is pretty quick in cathedral building time, because earlier cathedrals, some took 100 to 150, maybe even 200 years to build. The Sagrada Familia was only finished in the last year or two, I think, as well. And that's being built for...
Where is that, Linz?
In Spain, I believe it is.
Yes. Wow. That is an architecture and a half.
It's an amazing building. Wow. Yeah. In Barcelona.
That's correct.
And
yes.
If you have a look, you can see why it took so long to build. Yes. It actually started, here's a quick behind the scenes. I did a quick Google search. 1882 was when they started building the Sagrada Familia. So it's been in use in different ways over the years as different parts are opened up, but the actual completion of it, that's amazing to think about. It's this huge building, like to look at it and try and comprehend it is something in it of itself. But we have our wonderful, but humble, not even humble, but wonderful, it was an imposing building, St. Patrick's Cathedral, for such a long time. Now it's referred to as an icon of Melbourne. And that's and you know what? Fair enough. I think it deserves the title Icon of Melbourne, but it's more than an icon, if we're honest. It's a lot more than that.
It's a lot more than an icon.
It is one way to present the face of Christ to Melbourne, to the people of Melbourne, to the whole archdiocese as well. So with that in mind, I'd like to delve into some parts, and I won't do it justice because this is a two-part story, which is actually an abridged version of a much larger article as well. So, however, the links to these two articles will be in our show notes. And there are some great pictures, some pictures of plans, pictures of features of St. Patrick's Cathedral. And before I start as well, I just wanted to mention that there's also a Melbourne Catholic Precinct app that you can download. So if you live in Victoria and you want to use it, there's a self-guided tour. If you ever visit Melbourne and want to look at some of the Catholic history and the contemporary Catholic Church in Melbourne, the app is the Melbourne Precinct app. And I've put a link to it, at least to the Apple Store, in our show notes, but any app store should hopefully have it. And this app is basically a self-guided tour app. So you can walk around the Catholic precinct in Melbourne. And because it's self-guided, you can put your headphones in and listen to some of the and read some of the interesting features of that, including St. Patrick's Cathedral. So you can walk around the cathedral and listen to the app as it tells you, go here, look at this, here's some history and some things as well. I actually haven't used it yet. I really want to go into Melbourne and use it. I still, since it came out, haven't used it. So I've got to do it. Yeah. Maybe we'll do an episode on it at some point as well. Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Why not?
But with that in mind, the article is called Building Dreams, the Foundation of St. Patrick's Cathedral. And part one, dramatically, is called False Starts. And it talks about the issues that began. So anyway, Bishop James Gould, who was the Bishop of Melbourne at the time, he arrived in Australia in 1838, and he was stationed to start with in Campbelltown. So there's a suburb that we're familiar with. And he had witnessed Archbishop Polding's efforts to build Gothic churches around the Archdiocese of Sydney. Now, Archbishop Polding had a Benedictine dream, it was called. I remember doing some of this in uni, right? He had a dream of this monastic life and culture in the Australian church, and that included Gothic-style buildings and a cathedral. So we know of Gothic, artistic, gargoyles, all those different things that you would find on a cathedral. And it has a callback to a particular time in history where Gothic style helped to enhance the understanding and the connection to the sacred. And so Archbishop Polding had this dream, and Bishop James Gould also had this vision of Gothic style churches. One of those in particular, though, was the building of St. Patrick's Cathedral using the Gothic style. So the Gothic revival was accompanying the expansion of British colonies in Australia, and especially the Church of England saw it as a powerful tool to promote Anglicanism throughout the empire. As we know, the Anglican Church was the dominant church in Australia's emerging history. It was the majority one. Catholics were certainly in the minority at this time. Gothic was also, according to this article, a favorite of Roman Catholics as well. So Hugin, who was a Catholic convert and architect, he had imbued, it says here, the revival with moral associations, deeply entwining the style of Catholic faith and spirituality. So Hugin had seen a connection between Gothic style and Catholic spirituality. So Polding, during an ad limina visit, that is a visit to the Pope in Europe in the 1840s, he acquired several Gothic architectural drawings from Hugin and another architect called Charles Hansom, who was another Catholic revivalist architect. And Polding had the intention of promoting this realization in the churches in Australia, following the English medieval tradition. So according to Hugin, Gothic was the only truthful architecture, and its revival would not only foster a return to ancient Catholic spirituality and sacramentality, but also help to reposition Catholic faith at the center of everyday life. So Bishop Gould in Melbourne participated in these preparations. And so, what is it? He invited Hugin to select an architectural drawing for his new diocese in Melbourne. So in a letter to Gould in June 22nd, 1848, Polding recommended one of the plans designed by Charles Hansom, but Gould actually selected a plan by Hugin, the master of Gothic. So in Melbourne, building was a novelty. According to Hugin's theories, an attentive study of medieval Gothic buildings was necessary for the proper revival. So that's part of the decision making that went in, and Bishop Gould liked Hugin's designs and wanted to go with that. So in Melbourne at the time, the Port Phillip district was characterized by what's called a Gothic design. Now this is spelt G-O-T-H-I-C-K. So this is an idiom that was developed in the 18th, 19th centuries, which included romantic structures with picturesque elements. So essentially that it was Gothic, but there was some romanticism intertwined in it as well. One of the churches of this design was good old St. Francis's in Melbourne. Now we're familiar with St. Francis Church as well, Lido. And yeah. One thing I associate with St. Francis Church is the Catholic bookstore that they have right there, for which I have probably spent, I'm embarrassed to think of how much money I've spent in that bookshop because that was, for me, for a long time, the premier place to buy, and still is really in a lot of ways. If you go into Melbourne and want some books on spirituality or theology, Bibles, they've got a whole ton there. The Catholic bookshop at St. Francis Church was a big deal for me. It was one of the earliest churches in Melbourne. If I remember my history, was it Mary MacKillop was baptized there or received her confirmation there? Anyway, Mary MacKillop did have an association with St. Francis Church. And I know the family of Ned Kelly had an association there for a while as well.
Oh, okay.
And I can't remember what it is, but I'll have to look it up later, but there was some kind of association there as well. So a survey was done of the Eastern Hill in 1849. Now, the Eastern Hill is basically the site where the cathedral would be built. We know that St. Patrick's Cathedral is east of Melbourne, so the eastern part of the Melbourne precinct, which also has some great symbolism because we talk about in the time, the Latin Mass was done facing east, because East is symbolic of the resurrection. The sun rises in the east, right? So
true. Symbolic of the resurrection.
Mm. So we don't do mass facing east anymore, or some communities do, but still the symbolism of the east is something in our Catholic tradition that we understand, right? So it has
a whole lot of,
not just that it's a great site for the cathedral, but it's quite symbolic as well. So Bishop Gould in 1850 solemnly blessed the foundation stone of St. Patrick's Cathedral. It says, at the conclusion of an impressive celebration attended by more than 2,000 Catholics. So there was a big pomp and ceremony to bless the foundation stone, and then the building would then take place after that. So moving on then, a wooden structure was temporarily built to serve the local congregation. So there was a wooden church basically built on the site while the foundations are being dug. And the sum for these foundations was £900. Now,
that's a lot of money.
I was going to say, right?
Back in those days.
If you account for, you know, inflation, et cetera, I don't know what it is in Australian or American dollars, but we can say was a lot. Okay. It's quite a lot.
Yeah.
And in fact, there's some things in here which you'll giggle about when I get to it later on. So the contract to raise the walls to the windowsills was never finalized at the time, because something else happened, the Victorian Gold Rush. So we know about the Gold Rush. Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was really popular during those times.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, the 1800s.
Yeah, so the rush to the gold fields apparently shocked the Victorian economy in July 1851. And so what happened was, Gould was in Europe at the time, and his vicar, who was overseeing everything, Father Patrick Gagan, found it impossible to continue the work because most of the men left their workplace to try and their fortune on the gold fields.
On the gold field, rush. Yeah.
Yes, that's it. So trade and construction, a lot of it was left at a standstill around Melbourne because it was difficult to find the building materials or reliable workers. So, and then it says, get this, it said at the time, Melbourne had become one of the most expensive cities in the world.
Melbourne?
Yeah, that's right.
Wow. I thought Sydney was the most expensive.
I feel like that might be the case now. Sydney or the whole state of Queensland. I reckon that you might, but Melbourne actually became quite expensive because the economy went out of whack because of the gold fields and where people were trying their fortune in finding gold and so on, which we know not everyone found their fortune, and a lot of terrible things also happened because of that too. So Gould returned to Melbourne in 1853 and he was unsatisfied. It says here, he said in one of his letters, money has been most shamefully advanced to the contractor of St. Patrick's Church, Eastern Hill, during my absence, but little has been done for it. And he wrote this in 1853. So he appointed a new vicar, St. John Fitzpatrick, to manage the day-to-day building operations. And then there was a whole lot of fundraising. So, for example, lithograph of the proposed church was put on to raise money, etc. So despite the significant expenditure, according to the article, the efforts to build St. Patrick's halted less than a year later in March 1854, when the economy of Victoria registered a marked downturn, causing architect Jackson to go out of business. So now the architect is out of business, not a lot of workers. It was a bit of a disaster in trying to get the foundations going. So they had a foundation stone. They probably had some things dug. They had a wooden church and not a lot else to show for the money they'd spent. So not great, right? Yeah. And you know how terrible it can be when you try and do a build and it's a disaster, all right?
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah. Let alone people who try and build a house. And then you get, look, after lockdowns when a lot of builders went out of business. So
a lot of them went out of business for us
in
Australia.
And some of it during the construction of homes and businesses and building. You know, what a terrible thing that was for people. So you can imagine how people feel like that. Now imagine an entire cathedral, and right now the project is a massive failure, really, when you think about it. And again, this is where the false starts of the article is going to. So the next section talks about a second attempt. Works on the cathedral remained at a standstill for about 2 years. And so during that time, priority was given to St. Patrick's College to build there. And in the meantime, Gould hadn't given up. He was doing work. So he contacted Charles and Joseph Hansom in England, who were architects, to revive the project. Because sadly, Pugin, the original designer, had died prematurely in 1852. So now we need architects, so we need to get things going. So after the gold rushes, bluestone had become increasingly popular for construction as it was affordable. and it was also plentiful in the Melbourne area. Now, I'm going to make an association here, which may be correct or incorrect. I do know that in Ferntree Gully, there's an old quarry, which is now a park. And I've been there myself, right? So a colleague I know lives close to there. We had a work meeting at his house. And then for lunch, we went to the quarry. And there's like a lake and parkland and barbecues and whatever else. It's really nice there. However, this was a quarry for a lot of stone. Not the only quarry, but a quarry for a lot of stone that was used on the buildings in Melbourne. So when you go through and see the stone buildings and your intricate designs and the architecture and, and so on, a lot of that came from rock that was quarried in Melbourne.
Of course.
Your local area. And I'm wondering if local stone was used at St. Patrick's. I wonder if any of it came from the good old Ferntree Gully quarry as well. So
true. That's true.
Maybe a question for the Archbishop if we have him on the show later on.
I must admit, that's a long transport from Ferntree Gully to Melbourne.
I guess it wouldn't be that's too bad.
We didn't have the highways, so we're using horse and cart.
Yeah, I'd say cars would have been would have existed.
Trains would have been used. Yeah,
and keep in mind, talking about a 40-year project. So
it's true. Cars would have been invented or designed and everything, and transport would have been going faster and faster. So,
they say, the cathedral wasn't built in a day.
No, definitely not. No.
Neither was Rome, by the way, but that's a whole other thing. And you know what? Melbourne just didn't have any Roman concrete at the time. So, so good old bluestone had to do the trick. So anyway, so it was affordable. There was lots of it. And now, a lot of people actually judged it as too dark and solid for proper architectural treatment. But samples were sent to England together with the drawings of the foundations that were that had already been completed, those early foundations. And the Hampson brothers provided a new design that suited the new material, this bluestone, and matched the ground plan of the previous building. So they looked at the foundations that were built, they looked at the samples of the stone, and they drew new plans to incorporate what had already been built and then with this stone, that sample that had been sent. So the drawings were received. Local architects James and George Joseph Schneider were engaged to supervise the building of the new church. So the bluestone was used for the solid walls, characterized by plain lines. A lighter toned freestone was delicately sculpted for the refined the window sort of edges. So the amount needed for completion of the church was estimated now between 8,000 and 10,000 pounds. So again,
wow, that's
a lot of dollars.
Huge, from 900 to
pounds for the foundations. Yep. So now we're talking big dollars. But yes, that's when you build a cathedral, you're committing a lot of money. So funds are raised through weekly collections. And it says here, vehement appeals. I love that. And here's a great sample of one of the appeals.
Vehement.
So there's a bit of force behind it. So in 1855, the Catholic Directory for the Diocese of Melbourne wrote to its readers, St. Patrick's Temporary Chapel! Is this a reality or a fact? Or is it mere fiction? Is it possible that amid our daily increasing Catholic population, a population so abundant and ample in pecuniary resources, there stands but one poor, small, great, temporary chapel under the name of the great apostle of the Irish nation? So there was a bit of a push there to, hey, donate some funds because is it great that we have this large and growing Catholic population and just this little wooden church as our main building? We're not going to stand for that. Donate today. So I like that one.
It's like a subtle way of a sales pitch in a sense.
A bit of a sales pitch,
not in that sort of advertising bad way.
Yeah, it was a bit of a push, right? Do you want a nice cathedral or do you want a wooden church? What do you think, right? So get into
it.
Exactly. Yeah. And I doubt they were doing sausage sizzles in those days, so they had to have a bit of a push. And there were no Bunnings stores to do the goods.
I know.
Yeah,
all right. Yeah. We're going to have like full-on hardware depot places.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So works on this second design commenced in June 1856. And in 2 years, more than £15,000 was spent. So it's even bigger than what we talked about. To complete the foundations, raise part of the nave walls and complete the three bays of the southern aisle. So in a letter to Gould on the 10th of November, 1857, Fitzpatrick, this is the Vicar General, lamented that delays and disappointments barked the supervision of George and Schneider, who were simultaneously working on several projects. And the bishop had to borrow money to pay the contractors. So George and Schneider, the local architects, they were working on this, but they were also working on other projects as well. So there were delays, things were quite slow. And there's a great photo here from 1858 of the three bays which are enclosed. So if you look at the show notes later and find this link, it's nice to see this historical photo which exists of what's been what was created so far at that time. So January 1858, Gould recorded in his diary, "I looked over the works at St. Patrick's and examined the portion of the building that we expect to open soon." So this aisle was sealed off, a temporary wooden altar was put in, and an episcopal seat or the bishop's seat. Local artists painted it, and the interiors were prepared so that mass could be said in at least this part. So on the 14th of February, again, 1858, Gould sang pontifical high mass and blessed the first section of St. Patrick's. So the church was open for worship, at least that part of it. However, hopes of seeing it completed were crushed a few months later when George and Schneider failed to pay the contractors, leaving a debt of £900, which stopped the works. So now they're in debt.
Yeah.
The local architects had failed to pay the contractors. So what do you do as a contractor when you're not paid? You're down tools, right? Off we go.
Yeah, exactly.
So Fitzpatrick dismissed these architects, and there was a bit of a struggle to repay that debt because the debt was being paid for with the offerings of the local working class who were going to mass. So they weren't getting a ton of cash to pay this debt.
I was about to say, Leeds, that is a nice name for a contractor, George and Schneider. And then you find out that they went, oh, no.
And
that would have been a great name.
Just sadly, they weren't up to the job and left the archdiocese with a little, the diocese at the time, with a little bit of debt. So, however, Gould never gave up. So he left for Rome for another ad limitum visit to the Pope. And he proposed a more centralized system to continue the building of the cathedral. However, his financial management of the diocese was being questioned by local critics. So now people were starting to talk, look, they're in debt, isn't great. They're probably never going to get it done. So there was some pretty tough times going on. So he had the full support of Rome at this point. He returned to the diocese and he was ready to see his dream realized. And that's the end of part one. Dun, dun, dun. However, we're doing part two today. We're not going to leave you in suspense.
Okay. We're not leaving hanging. Oh, come on,
no,
man.
I know. It'd be great to leave. No, we don't want to leave people hanging.
Of course. So. No, talk to podcasters. All the people are listening. Going, yeah. What's part two? Yeah. You have to wait for another couple of weeks, guys. I mean,
if they want, they can Google it and read it. So we're not going to leave them hanging. Anyway,
oh, I'm sure. Yeah. Well, that sort of sense, yeah.
So we'll put that in the measure. We'll keep going, yeah. So, so part two is called Building Dreams, the Foundation of St. Patrick's Cathedral. Now it's called Wardell's Vision. So let's get into this, and I'm just going to briefly go through this part. So Bishop Gould was in Europe in 1858 on his second ad limitum visit. William Wardell settled in Melbourne during this time. He was originally from London. He had trained as an architect and converted to Catholicism, and he'd worked on the Catholic Church in England for more than a decade. Almost all of his churches had been designed in a Gothic Revival style. Tick. Perfect. All right. So faithful to Pugin's principles that architectural historian Henry Russell Hitchcock judged him the ablest of Roman Catholic architects working in the tradition of Pugin. Tick. All right. So this was the guy. So the vicar Fitzpatrick was happy to meet Wardell and he was very impressed with him. And he wrote to Gould from September to November 1858. And he said, "Mr. Wardell appears to be just the man we want." So it says, he appears to be a good Catholic, all right, so great, and competent to carry on any building that may be required in Melbourne. So Gould had heard lots of good things about him from English priests as well, people around England where Wardell had previously worked, and he wrote back to Fitzpatrick and said, "I have been speaking to several persons of Mr. Wardell, and they are all loud in his praise. By all means, engage him. Get him. This is the guy we want, right? Engage him. Let's do it." So
looks like this Wardell had good cred.
Yep, he had good cred. So Wardell got the job. And so we get on to then the building of a grand cathedral, matching the size of Gothic examples dating back to the Middle Ages, which was the dream of every Gothic revivalist. And Wardell could be the man to realize it in Melbourne. So he visited the site of the Eastern Hill, measured, sketched, and then a few weeks later, his grand design was forwarded to Rome for the bishop's approval. So in the wake of the gold rushes, Melbourne had seen the creation of other buildings that we're aware of, Lino, such as the Public Library, the University of Melbourne, Parliament House, and Treasury Building. And these were all, they're around today. They are major, impressive city buildings, right? So the city's development, it says here, had been incredible. The Catholic population was growing with the city. So their dream of having a grand cathedral recalling ancient Catholic tradition, was finally close at hand. So they had an architect, and it was time to get going, right? So Wardell, given freedom to design the cathedral, he had only one condition imposed on his process, and that is that it was to incorporate as much as possible of the previous building to avoid unnecessary expenses. Don't rip everything down and start all over again.
That sort of makes sense. Yeah,
look at what's already there and build on that as much as you can, because otherwise this is going to get quite expensive. So reasonable.
Yeah.
Right? So Wardell's building, his design, dwarfed the previous design. Yeah, though the already open southern aisle was included in the new church, while all the other sections of the buildings were demolished. So the other parts were demolished or whatever else. However, some of the original was kept, and he had quite an ambitious design. During this time, there were people criticizing Gould. They criticized, it says, his ruthlessness in adopting a new design for St. Patrick's. So what? Another new design? This is your third go, right?
And that's true. That is true.
So he was getting publicly criticized. However, he was encouraged by Robert Wilson, who was the Bishop of Hobart, who'd also been a friend to Pugin as well. And he wrote to Gould in 1859 in February and said the following, I think this is prophetic. He said, "The good sense of many will overcome much noisy opposition. The noise may be for a few months, the improvements for centuries." Isn't that beautiful?
Oh, wow.
The legacy of the cathedral will go through the centuries. No one's going to remember the noise. And he was right, wasn't he?
That's true.
How prophetic
that is
that?
That's true.
Because of Gould's vision, Leo, you and I in our growing early adult years had a cathedral that was part of the formation of our faith.
That's correct.
I find that incredible. Yep. You know what I mean? If Gould had succumbed to the noise, we'd have a small church or something, right? But not this beautiful thing that we have today that has affected the faith of so many. And Archbishop Comensoli said in his Patrick Oration to continue that growth and effect on people's faith into the future. So thank God Gould didn't succumb to the pressure. It says he was quite ruthless in his, we're going to do this. So the works started in 1858 in December and continued without significant delays for the next 40 years. And under Fitzpatrick, the Vicar General's careful management, the building was cleared of debts in 1863. The nave was completed in 1868 and temporarily sealed off to be used for liturgies, while works on the transepts and the sanctuary continued. So the cathedral, it says here, I loved this paragraph, the cathedral was continually enriched with items from the best workshops in Australia and the world, including a soapstone baptismal font created by Mr. William Lambert in Portland, a cathedral realized by local master carver George Bell, a peal of bells from Murphy in Dublin, mosaics from Salviati in Venice, stained glass windows from Hardman's in Birmingham and from Mayer's in Munich, a marble crucifix from Altman's studio in Rome, and altars from Farmers and Brindley's in London. How amazing that all of these objects and items used for worship were from all over the world.
And
local. And I actually didn't know any of this. So I really want to go and have another look at all of these things and use the app and learn more about their history and see them in person again. I find that.
I know I'm being silly about this, but if you can imagine putting the app over and then you get like a, what's it called? A little pop-up from Amazon going, yeah, we sell this for you.
Yeah, yeah. Buy a replica. Yeah. Same day delivery too. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, leave some feedback on your delivery.
Yeah, exactly. That's so incredible with all different parts of the church coming from different parts of the world. Yeah. That's great.
And there are photos of these in the article as well. You can scroll through the stained glass windows, the sanctuary,
the
baptismal font. So those are, people can see those in the article as well, or in person if you're local.
If you like the local,
So the building was done. Became a prominent
prayer time.
absolutely, 100%. Yeah, so it became a prominent landmark in Melbourne in the 19th century cityscape, and people of different confessions expressed their wish. So as people were seeing the progress go on, they wanted to see it built. Now they're like, "Oh, look at it! We really want to see this finished." So on the 22nd of June 1880, the Argus, so a local, I'm assuming a local publication, predicted that the new cathedral designed by, quote, one of the best ecclesial architects in the colonies would remain for all time a conspicuous monument of religious zeal and generosity. We say for all time because it is built so as to last for ages. So it says here, nothing has been sacrificed to haste or an injudicious economy. every detail throughout the building, from the stick tiles, I love the language here, in the pavement, to the lead of the roof ridge, displays good designing skill and first-class workmanship applied to the very best materials. So it says here, it is not too much to say that St. Patrick's Cathedral is the most substantial and honestly put up building in Melbourne, besides being by far the grandest church in the colony. So it was built. It happened. So Bishop Gould, it says here in conclusion, started his episcopacy with two churches and three clergymen. Under his guidance, the Diocese of Melbourne, this is before it was an archdiocese. So then it was elevated to an archdiocese in 1874. It came to include more than 70 stone churches, so many that one of his priests, Father Fitzgerald, said on December 1885 that Gould had blessed more foundations and cornerstones than perhaps any prelate since the days of St. Patrick. So Gould had single-mindedly pursued this vision of a Gothic cathedral in Pugin's tradition. Wardell was the right one to redesign that third attempt and finish it. And together they were able to fulfill this Gothic dream. After 40 years it was built, it attracted support from different denominations and different people, and it became a symbol of pride for the young Melbourne colony. So the Gothic lines, it says to conclude, of St. Patrick's embodied an ancient religious tradition, and seeing it towering above marvellous Melbourne was the realisation of a dream for all Australian Catholics. Their faith was claiming a central place in Australian society. So that's the story, at least in basic, of St. Patrick's Cathedral. It's a great history. Now, there are articles that go into a lot more depth and there's a lot more detail, but at least as a summary, we wanted to offer that today. So, Lino, before we move on, did you want to say anything else about that history at all?
That is an amazing history. Like we're talking about, just building your own house, what Bernie and I did, it's take months and planning, getting the plans, getting the where when you want to build it and everything like that. The material, and the sad reality is for Australia is that parts of materials are getting a bit, stocks are getting a bit low, and building companies are falling because the suppliers are not coming in through.
Yeah.
But the story about the cathedral, how many, 40 years to build, like we were saying, it wasn't built in a year or two or three.
Or a decade,
Built a decade, yeah. It had to be built right.
Yeah.
And the process of even building a building, it's huge. Just making sure that you got the right, like we're sort of talking about the rocks, timber. And also back in those days, we even sometimes talk about how the Egyptians built the pyramids.
Yeah,
right. I would say that was a huge architecture thing to do back in those days. And back in for them, they're making sure that everything was built right. Don't know if there was accidents that happened.
Most likely.
I'm not 100% sure.
Yeah.
And how things were built and everything like that.
Yeah.
But
they didn't have
it's amazing.
Else design the pyramids, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, true. That is true, yeah. It's amazing how we as a human race can build so much buildings and structures. It amazes you still.
It's amazing that we can build buildings as grand as a cathedral. It's also amazing the design, the intent,
exactly
overlaid on top of that, and having a Gothic style is, which is again unique in Melbourne, like for our churches there. Because that's the style that will be there forever now. It's one of Melbourne's Gothic buildings.
Exactly.
You know, and again, as I said at the start, the sacredness of that beautiful place. And not even just walking to the cathedral, walking around the grounds of the cathedral as well. You've got all kinds of beautiful things that you can just sit and engage from that, the fountain that runs all the way down, how amazing that is. The statues of different saints.
True.
Like Mary MacKillop. I love the statue of George Preker, the Maltese saint as well. I mentioned in the last episode, I had my graduation for my master's there, right? I made sure to have a photo with his statue, just that beautiful connection of a Maltese saint as well. Malta's first saint, by the way, as well. So
it's great, wasn't it? Yeah, wasn't it?
So before you even enter the cathedral, there's Catholic spirituality on the grounds that you can experience. And then appreciating it, the cathedral itself from the outside, and so many angles you could walk around it from Australian Catholic University. You can look at it through the windows and get a different perspective. It's such a beautiful building. And just to finish off my thought, on Facebook weeks ago now, the ABC in Melbourne, right, on their Facebook page took an aerial photo of the cathedral with the caption, an icon of Melbourne. And it was a beautiful photo. It's got good angles wherever you look at it from, right? Which so that's a testament to the design of the cathedral, which is great. Which says, because there's that invitation to come into this beautiful building. And
definitely,
it's also by extension the beautiful invitation of Christ into relationship. And I love it for that. Yep. And again, you and I have experienced this ourselves and people that we've gone with. So there you go. I've really enjoyed talking about the history of it. It's a beautiful read, and I actually probably want to go read in a bit more detail now after
that. Everything went and everything goes. It's amazing how those sort of buildings were built. We talk about the one in Barcelona. They finished, don't quote me, they finished the one in France, Notre Dame. Are they finished building that?
So the goal was to finish it by the Olympics of this year.
Exactly.
I'm fairly sure they finished, or they've at least made it accessible again to the public.
Yes.
Because it would be a disaster if they didn't have...
All these people... Listeners, is that we're not talking about them finishing it. There was a fire that happened in Notre Dame. So they're
refurbishing. Myself and Jared, years ago on the podcast, we talked about it as well, because it was quite sad that it had happened. Because then a couple of years before we started the podcast, I'd actually been to Notre Dame Cathedral
on
my holiday. Yeah. And an amazing, beautiful, again, I think I did mention last episode, when you go to a city around the world, see if they've got a local cathedral. You should always.
Yes, exactly.
To visit. Yeah. All right. We could keep talking about this, but we need to move on. So let's move from Bluestone Rock to Moon Rock, and let's talk about science.
What a fine day for science.
You have any hobbies?
I collect spores, molds, and fungus.
Can you reverse the polarity?
I'll do my best.
Science.
Yeah, I like science. So I'm going to be brief with this one. But you may have heard in the news recently that the United States and a coalition of other countries will now set a standardized time for the moon. The moon will have a time zone. So I'm looking forward to the idea when this does happen. Now, we're still not there. We've still got some time to go before they sort all of this out, because there's actually a lot of science that will need to go into this. I would like, you know how on your watch or your phone you can set different times of the world, so you can have your time. You know, I've got Malta time on my watch, so because
I've got
family,
Malta time and the Philippines time. Just
can
in case.
Can you imagine you've got all these times, and then you have moon time as well, like standard moon time? I can't wait for that. I reckon that's so cool. So
it would still make sense, but maybe 50 or 100 years from now, we'll be able to live on the moon.
Yeah.
So if you have a relative or a family friend who lives on the moon, making sure that you text them, not at 1 o'clock in the morning time. Yeah.
You need to know when moon time is, so that your friends on the moon, that when you text them, you don't accidentally, 3 o'clock in the morning. It might be 12 noon for you, but it's not for them. They're trying to have their moon snooze. They've got a busy day the next day. So here's what I'll do. Very briefly, now it's 4 pages long. I'm not going to go through all of it, but there was a memorandum for the departments and agencies participating in the White House Cislunar Technology Strategy Interagency Working Group. So basically, they've been directed by the President of the United States. So it says here, the memorandum outlines the Biden-Harris administration's policy to establish time standards at and around celestial bodies other than Earth to advance the national Cislunar S&T technology. So the Science Department of the United States has directed federal departments and agencies to align their planning and policies with this memorandum. The approach to establish time standards consists of the definition, development, and implementation of a distinct reference time at each celestial body and its surrounding space environment. Each new time standard developed will include the following features. 1, traceability to coordinated universal time. So the UTC on Earth, right? So the universal sort of time. So it needs to be traceable to the current system that exists on Earth. So with all of our time zones, it needs to be adaptable to that. Number two, accuracy sufficient to support precision navigation and science. So it's actually related to navigation in our solar system and the moon and so on. So coordinating navigation and science that happens as well. 3, resilience to loss of contact with Earth. So if for any reason the moon internet went down or whatever.
Yeah, that's true. You know, whatever it may sound funny, but it makes sense.
Yeah,
makes sense.
Moon time wouldn't be lost. It would still have its own independent time. Mm. And also scalability to space environments beyond the Earth-Moon system, which I love. I love that. It's so cool. So essentially what's going on, Lino, is they want, first of all, there to be a standard moon time that works in conjunction with Earth's universal coordinated time.
Wow.
And eventually, as humanity branches out to the rest of the solar system,
exactly,
you'll have Mars time and the moons of Mars time.
Moons of time. Oh, wow. We're going to have a lot of. Yeah.
So I just wanted to clarify as well. So it's about moon time. It also says cislunar time as well. So cislunar is any space outside of the moon which is affected by the moon's gravity. So the moon's sphere of influence of its gravity. So that time period would also include the moon's orbit and beyond to where the moon's gravitational pull ends, or where we think it ends. So it wouldn't just be on the surface of the moon, but it would also be in the moon's space, if that makes sense, the space the moon occupies.
Yeah. Have we measured rotations of planets and how many, like, have we done that already? Is there more days?
Well, we know how time works because of the expanded orbit. So the further they are from the sun, the longer it takes for them to go around the sun. So therefore, the length
of days
and the length of years and so on other planets is affected. Yeah. So you can imagine the math and the science that's going to have to go into creating a time zone for the moon, let alone other planets as we go on. All right. So,
oh my goodness me.
However, 2 things. 1, luckily it's not our problem, Lido. And secondly, the first job is to get it right for the moon before they look anywhere else.
They have to get
it right for the moon. So basically, the countries in all of this coalition and the different space agencies, they want what's called an LTC, or Coordinated Lunar Time. That's what it's going to be called. So, you know, we've got Eastern Standard Time and all the others. So the moon's one will be called LTC, and it will apply to the whole moon. So there won't be time zones on the moon. It'll be the whole moon and, the cislunar, or the space that the moon occupies as well. And from national agencies such as NASA, the European Space Agency, JAXA and all these other ones, and the Chinese Space Agency, whose name I forgot, and Russia and all these other ones anyway, these are going to ramp up big time now. And also private companies as well. Mm. Don't forget, we've got SpaceX. Eventually, Amazon will have its Blue Origin, and all these other companies. They're also going to be ramping up their moon missions as well. So there needs to be a common reference of time.
Otherwise, that makes sense.
Yeah, otherwise what will happen is there'll be a whole lot of confusion. So it says here confusion from small inconveniences to much graver, more dangerous problems, such as mapping inconsistencies, navigation errors, and so on. So an unnamed White House office source says, imagine if the world wasn't syncing their clocks to the same time, how disruptive that might be and how challenging everyday things would become. So it would be a complete nightmare. So they need to do this now because, as we said, moon missions are going to ramp up. So the White House is giving NASA until the end of 2026 to implement the final standardized time system, which it says must have 4 qualities, which I've already mentioned. So, and the reason for this is so that precise scientific study, spacecraft landings, self-sufficiency, like I said, in case the contact with Earth is lost, and scalability to the rest of the solar system need to reference this moon time standard. And the moon time standard will reference Earth standard. So a lunar time standard will enable better communication between spacecraft, data transfers, landing, docking, navigation, and so on.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
Yeah, it's all.
When we were talking about it before, rocket from Earth to Moon, it's like you're waiting at a terminal. And he'll say, Tokyo time.
Yeah, that's
and
right.
And then you have to make sure that you get to Malta.
As that sounds, in reality, at some point, travel to the moon will become a normal thing, because this isn't just about missions to the moon, but this is about permanently establishing a human presence on the moon as well. So you exactly. will need a departing at whatever time. And when this eventually, and this might not be in our lifetime, who knows, but when it becomes commercialized and there's moon, affordable moon
tourism,
you'll need all of that. You know what I mean? So your spaceports will need to have the board with the numbers that flip and what time. And
It may sound silly.
It sounds silly and far-fetched, but they're doing it. They're doing it.
Right, they have to do it. Of course, we'll talk about supply chains and transport and logistics.
Yeah.
Moving things back and forth and everything. These transporters need to know to get there. I'd be surprised Uber will be around.
Uber Moon.
Uber Space.
Yeah, Uber Space. Yeah. Now, actually, think about this, right? And now there will be businesses doing courier stuff to the moon and back.
Exactly. 100%. Exactly.
You know what I'm thinking as well, in being Catholic podcasts, the first church on the moon. You know what I mean?
And there you go. And
considering
there
you what go. We're talking about, maybe the first moon cathedral. Can you imagine?
You know what I mean? Exactly. Exactly. The first stone. Yeah.
It sounds foundation silly. Stone. But let's keep this in mind.
Catholics and Christians
will be going to the moon at some point for work reasons, whatever it might be. With lots of Catholic and Christian astronauts have already gone to space, right?
Exactly.
They'll need a place of worship. 100%, right?
Yep.
So I'm not being far-fetched or silly.
It will happen.
Where this is going to have to be a consideration.
Definitely.
Yeah. So now what it says here is, the moon will have just one time zone and no daylight savings. However,
that
sounds simpler.
I'm not going to say that I like daylight savings. Yeah,
it seems like they don't think it's necessary. However, this is still a difficult project for NASA officials and scientists because it says factors like mass, not church mass, but like the weight of the moon gravity, it affects how time passes as well. So for example, an example to consider is that right now on Earth, the gradual redistribution of mass or weight due to melting sea ice is forcing scientists to reconsider how we keep time here on Earth.
I've heard rumors, but maybe seasons may have to change in different parts of the world.
Who knows, right? Because mass climate and gravity change and affect, does affect time. So that's a scientific consideration. Mm-hmm. So on the moon, a smaller body where gravitational pull is much weaker, time moves more quickly and unevenly. So lunar time gains around 58.7 microseconds per day compared to Earth time. And even this can vary depending on the altitude and longitude of where lunar clocks may be located. So this is a pretty challenging thing that needs to be done. So the Artemis program, which we've celebrated, which is sending astronauts to the moon and then eventually to settle there, it's sending astronauts to the moon, so the moon landing, around September 2026. All right, now that's actually not a lot of time in space
travel. Exactly. When you think about it, I know it's 2024, but years fly.
Yeah, and this is a few months before the deadline to implement LTC or Moon Coordinated Lunar Time. So later missions, as we know, part of the Artemis mission will be to establish a lunar base, and the lunar base will eventually be geared towards ensuring flights to Mars because it's actually easier to launch a rocket from the moon to Mars than it is from Earth to Mars. It's actually more
efficient
to do
that. That sort of makes sense.
Yep. So other countries are also planning on populating the moon. China has announced a 2030 target for astronauts to go to the lunar surface, and India by 2040. And they won't be the only ones. There'll be others at some point as well. Now, China and Russia haven't signed on to the Artemis Accords for this just yet. So it remains to be seen if these countries and others who aren't participating will also adopt LTC or not. So there's still some work to do there as well. So
definitely,
So that all of the officials, however, do recognize that there does need to be a lunar standard time, whether countries are part of the Artemis Accords or not. So manager of NASA's Space Communications and Navigation Program told The Guardian, an atomic clock on the moon will tick differently at a different rate to a clock on Earth. And he says it makes sense that when you go to another body like the moon or Mars, that each one gets its own heartbeat. So there we are, Luno. Sorry, Luno. A lunar standard time. Yeah, sorry.
I love your dog.
Luna, yeah. I know, I got all these L's in my head. Yeah, it's a big L for Lindsay. So there we have it. It's not just a novelty or a gimmick to establish a lunar time.
It's definitely not.
Yeah.
No, It made totally sense because when time is for us to colonize and move from planet to planet, we will need this. Yeah. We will need this. And also there'll be Mars's
standard time.
Maybe Mars
will have to have time zones. I'm assuming it's a much bigger body.
That would have a time zone on their side.
Much larger planet.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yep.
Exactly. Yeah. I must admit, man, goodness me. Oh, I could imagine going to Mars. You'll have to shoot out from Earth, stop by the moon.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It's a bit of a journey. So you have a layer over on the moon. Yeah, that's right.
Oh, yeah. It is a huge journey.
We call it.
And then have a bit of a bite to eat and watch it. Yeah, and we even stand there on the moon.
Check out the sites. Check out the Catholic cathedral on the moon.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And I'll I don't know how Mars will hold on. That's going to be interesting. Building something there, but.
Yeah, that's a whole other. Yeah, I'm sure they're thinking about it and designing, but that's a whole. I mean, they've got to get people there first. That's the first step.
Exactly.
Safely get humans to Mars and back to Earth again that's a
huge thing. Yeah. Yep.
Yep. We'll wrap up the show. I think we're getting a bit close to time, so we won't go to entertainment today, but we do have something to talk about. We'll save that we might do a larger segment on that in the future. But in the meantime.
No problem.
Yeah, we want to thank everyone for joining us for episode 117 of The Catholics of Oz. And before we go, we'd like to take a moment to thank our patrons who make it possible for us to create the show. Today, we would love to thank Jedediah H., Arthur B., Edward C., Patricia T., and Catherine L. Through their generous donations at sqpn.com/give, they make it possible for The Catholics of Oz and all the other great shows on StarQuest to continue. You can join them by visiting sqpn.com/give. Also, we'd like to know your thoughts about the topics we've discussed today. You can send us feedback by visiting sqpn.com/oz, where you can also find our show notes. While you're on the SQPN website, don't forget to sign up to the Insiders Club newsletter and get updates about all of your favorite shows, sqpn.com/about/newsletter. And come and talk about your favorite shows on SQPN's Discord, sqpn.com/discord. You can sign up there and speak to show hosts and other enthusiasts who listen to SQPN shows. It's a lot of fun there. So you're more than welcome to join us there. And you can find more about the shows and what's coming up by signing up to SQPN socials. So facebook.com/StarQuestMedia or Twitter at SQPN. And Instagram, StarQuest Media. I have to always remember that one. So don't forget the Catholics of Oz Facebook page as well. You can have a chat about our shows there, facebook.com/CatholicsOZ, or good old email, catholicsofoz@sqpn.com. Lito, thank you so much for being part of episode 117 today.
It has been totally spacey rocky.
It's been lunar.
Does that make sense? I don't know.
It's been lunar. It's been stellar.
And it's been stellar.
And eventually it'll be interstellar when they apply LTC.
Oh, my goodness me.
Yeah, that's right. Stellar.
Oh, wow. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, awesome. All right. And once again, I'm Lindsay Sant. And thank you so much for joining us for episode 117 of The Catholics of Oz on StarQuest.
Here's another show on the StarQuest Network you're sure to enjoy. PrayStation Portable. Find it wherever fine podcasts are found or at starquest.fm/PSP. We'd like to thank Patrick McCaffrey of Moonshadow Studios for editing this episode. To have your audio edited professionally and with care, check out more of Patrick's work at moonshadowstudios.biz. That's moonshadowstudios.biz.